All right, we are back. Our last segment today. Last week, we had quite an interesting talk with Dr. Lynn Roller, professor of classics and art history at UC Davis. She spoke to us about what were the ancient cultures of Mesopotamia, better known today as Iraq. At the end of the discussion last week, we talked about the grave concern of the archaeological community that a lot of these treasures, which have been dug out of the ground in the Tigris-Euphrates river basins, could be lost, as unfortunately too often happens with war. I found some encouragement in a piece that I found on the web I wanted to add to the record here. The Iraq Museum in Baghdad, according to this article that comes out of Newsweek, I believe, was being heavily sandbagged last week. This is reporting in, I believe, late February, a couple weeks before the war, and closed to the public while workers frantically packed its immense treasures into metal trunks. Rare documents and books, including gold leaf copies of the Quran printed on silk paper, were being packed away at Baghdad's Abdul Qadir al-Kalini Mosque. 4,000 museum pieces were stolen in 1991, said Jaber al-Takriti, the Iraq Museum's director of antiquities. This time, we have a plan. The article noted that during the 1991 Gulf War, near the ancient city of Ur, which we talked about in the program, near the mouth of the Euphrates River, the Iraqi Air Force basically parked their jets near Ur's 4,000-year-old ziggurat, in essence daring the Americans to shoot it up. Well, apparently this did not discourage the American military. And they did shoot up the planes, despite being parked next to a treasured archaeological site. And I didn't realize that after this, American soldiers, according to the article, toured the ancient tower and then got out their entrenching tools and began digging for souvenirs. A forlorn Iraqi gatekeeper ran among them, wailing protests in Arabic until U.S. officers put a stop to the looting. Now, in all the chaos of the last Gulf War, apparently 9 of 13 regional museums were completely looted. As the embargo wore on and economic conditions worsened in Iraq, apparently Iraqi citizens began tearing into unexcavated sites with front-end loaders and carrying away anything of value. The article notes it's a minor irony that Saddam's brutal police state had been exceptionally conscientious about protecting Iraq's cultural heritage, partly for his own megalomaniacal reasons. He basically sees himself as, a great, glorious figure in the mold of Nebuchadnezzar. So when he would rebuild palaces, he would, pay tribute to what he considers his predecessors. I certainly hope, as does everyone, that in the wake of the current war, that there'll be a minimal loss of these great treasures of archaeology that, really belong to all mankind. Talking with Dr. Roller did inspire me to pull off the shelf one of my Penguin classics, The Epic of Gilgamesh, which we told you about. And I thought it was interesting to read just the first paragraph, which I'll do from the prologue for you. "I will proclaim to the world the deeds of Gilgamesh. This was the man to whom all things were known. This was the king who knew the countries of the world. He was wise. He saw mysteries and knew secret things. He brought us a tale of the days before the flood. He went on a great long journey, was weary, worn out with labor. Returning, he rested. He engraved on a stone the whole story." It's interesting to read this and realize this was written 1,500 years before the time of Homer. I mean, this was further back from the time of Homer than the writing of the Quran is from our present time. And those dates would be for you something like 2300 BC, at least, for the Epic of Gilgamesh. Homer lived in 800 BC, and the Quran was written in the 7th century. Now, to reiterate from last week's program, we know about the Epic of Gilgamesh because it was discovered in an archaeological dig in the 1800s. The Sumerians would write on tablets of clay, which could be preserved very well, which were preserved in large numbers. There was a library in the Assyrian city of Nineveh that was excavated, and the Assyrians had basically held on to this bit of culture from the much earlier Sumerians, much as we might revere the works of, you know, ancient Greece and Rome. This classic passed into our hands thanks to the library compiled by the Assyrians, I believe, under King Assurbanipal. Something we didn't clarify for the geographically challenged on last week's program, Syria and Assyria are not the same thing. Syria is today the area that would include southeastern Turkey, the Republic of Syria, and probably parts of Lebanon. Assyria is the upper reaches of the Tigris-Euphrates area, particularly the Tigris, that would today be located in Iraq. It also would have included parts of southeastern Turkey as well. Now, we covered a lot of ground last week talking about what were the ancient cultures of modern Iraq with Dr. Roller. And I would like to put in quite a plug for the archaeologists of the past couple centuries. Until people started getting out tools and carefully excavating and digging and noting what they found and where they found it, we did not have a very good picture about many ancient cultures. In fact, about all we had in the way of information about what is today's Iraq was what came to us from the Bible and the Greeks and other cultures, which are rather Johnny-come-lately to the whole matter of civilization. I mean, there were cities, the stirrings of what we would consider civilization in the area of Iraq, you know, 6,000 years B.C. But had you asked a scholar in the time of, say, George Washington, what they knew about the Sumerians, you'd have gotten quite a blank look, because nobody knew much of anything about the Sumerians or the Akkadians or these various cultures that came before the time of the Bible. We knew about the Chaldeans, we knew about the Persians, but they came very late to the scene. What the Bible refers to as Babylonia or the Chaldean civilization are basically the same thing. They're what basically was the new Babylonian civilization. The Babylonians, the time of Hammurabi, goes back 1,000 years before that. The Sumerians, the time of King Sargon, who we talked about, is 500 years before that. Knowledge of these cultures was lost to history until archaeologists started digging things up. For that matter, in the 1800s, we had lost most of our information about Egypt. Even though there were hieroglyphics everywhere, we lost the ability to read the language as recorded by the Egyptians. It's a very famous story. In 1803, when Napoleon was doing some adventurism around in Egypt, they dug up a stone, which is the famous Rosetta Stone. It had messages in three different languages, which allowed scholars to decipher what was being stated in the language of the Egyptians, hieroglyphics. Much the same thing took place with cuneiform, which was the language of the ancient Sumerians. Tablets were dug up, and fortunately a key was found, which in similar fashion to the Rosetta Stone enabled people to decipher what the language said. Now to recap, Sumeria came first. Akkad was superimposed upon Sumeria under King Sargon, which went conquering. Babylonia arose in the southern part of the region when the Amorites came in. They also founded what became Assyria. One fact I find very curious we didn't get into last week was that about 1300 BC, a group called the Aramaeans entered the area, and their language, Aramaic, came to dominate the whole Fertile Crescent. By the time of Jesus, it was the vernacular of the Jewish people, and Jesus himself spoke Aramaic, not Hebrew, and it survives even today in a few villages in Syria. People still speak the language of Jesus. Now, it's clear in reading the Epic of Gilgamesh that much of the Bible's story about Noah has its roots in the epic. The parallels are quite interesting, that there's a man that builds a boat. He takes on board various types of creatures, both domestic and wild. As the waters subside, he sends out birds He knows when a raven does not return that basically dry land is back. The parallels are quite striking, although this certainly does not sit well who believe that the Bible is the literal revealed word of God. It's hard to square that with the fact that the story appears to have an earlier source. Now, one of the most truly amazing parts about the intertwined history of the Jewish people and that of the Tigris-Euphrates area is that in about 725 BC, Israel's capital, the capital of ancient Israel, Samaria, was laid siege to by Shalmaneser V, the Assyrian king. He died soon after that, but this failed to save the capital of Samaria. In 722 BC, the capital of the Kingdom of Israel fell to the Assyrians, now being led by the new king, Sargon II, who obviously was using the illustrious name of the king that had lived 1,600 years before him to burnish his image. Sargon II's method of ensuring tranquility in conquered areas was pretty simple. He deported the aristocracy back to Assyria. This was done to Samaria, and thus the ancient people of Israel, the people who were living in the northern part of what had been the Kingdom of David, which was consisted of Israel in the north and Judah in the south, was mixed into the population of Assyria, today's Iraq. And through a loss of customs and intermarriage, the ancient nation of Israel was blended into the Assyrian population. I find this curious because over the millennia, there's been, you know, endless speculation over the supposed lost tribes of Israel. Where did they go? Well, there really isn't any great mystery about where they went. They went to Iraq, where presumably the descendants of the 10 tribes, these 10 tribes of Israel, can still be found today. Now, I'll grant you, there's been a tremendous amount of mixing, endless invasions of this part of the world, including the current one. But I don't doubt that a large percentage of people who were once citizens of Israel today live in Iraq. Now, the smaller remnant state of Judah, what had once been King David's kingdom, managed to survive for a couple decades after this. In 701 BC, King Sennacherib, who had succeeded Sargon II, made some moves against Judah. He laid siege to Jerusalem, but the city held on. It was aided by an illness, which evidently struck those making the siege. So the Assyrians decided that it was too much bother to go after Jerusalem. They left them alone. Now, fast forward almost a century, the Assyrians fell to the Chaldeans, who were the folks that had been hanging around in what had been Babylonia. So what had been the Assyrian Empire in the north now became the new Babylonian Empire, led by an able king, Nebuchadrezzar II, also known as Nebuchadnezzar. Now, the ancient Greeks were really impressed with this guy. This is the guy that had the Hanging Gardens of Babylon, which they named as one of the wonders of the world at that time. The Jewish people think considerably less well of the king because he decided to complete what the Assyrians had started out to do 115 years earlier. And indeed, in 586, the Chaldeans of New Babylonia succeeded in sacking Jerusalem. Like Sargon II of Assyria before him, the Chaldean king Nebuchadrezzar carted off the leading families of the kingdom. They were deported back to Babylonia. But unlike the ancient nation of Israel, the nation of Judah was not lost to history. It turned out the Chaldeans were benign supervisors of their subjects, and in the New Babylonia, Jews prospered. A religious revival took place in the transplanted population, and religious writings formed a cultural focus during what's called the Babylonian captivity. And in fact, in this part of the world, what we think of as the Old Testament was basically brought together over the next century or two. Now, the Chaldean or New Babylonian state didn't last very long. When Cyrus of Persia came conquering, the whole area got incorporated into a large Persian empire. We only touched on this a bit on last week's program, and we are just about out of time today, so we can't go much further. But the Persians influenced the Jews living in what was Babylonia very profoundly. There was a great influence of the Persian state religion, Zoroastrianism, in Judaism. If you read your Bible, for example, you will note that the first 16 books of the Bible, influenced as they were by Sumerian, Akkadian legends, and Egyptian history, do not personify a counterforce to God. But contact within the Persian Empire did personify such a negative force. Satan originated in Zoroastrianism, the religion of Persia. Zoroaster, its founder, developed a faith that saw the universe divided between good and evil, and then a great cosmic battle took place between good and evil, and it was a battle in which man could play a role. The personification of the counterforce to God would become, in the Old Testament, Satan. And on that note, I think we need to end today's program. Our many thanks to Steve Alexander for joining us on this program. Next week's show will be our Picnic Day special. We're going to talk a great deal about UC Davis's open house to the world. And we'll talk a little bit about our usual things. We're going to try and insert our long postponed segment on genetic engineering. So look forward to that in the next week or at the most two. You have been listening to Radio Parallax. I'm Douglas Everett, and this is KDVS 90.3 FM. This program was engineered by Mr. Edward McMillan. Now, as usual, at this point in time, we're going to do the handoff between this program and Hometown Atrocities, Todd Yurick's program, which follows. And Todd plays for you many interesting eclectic selections. I purchased a CD some weeks back for some of the bumper music we use on the show, and noted some odd choices on one of these discs. It was called TV's Classic Game Show Themes. And I played the whole CD while driving around the car one day, and I thought, man, these are some rarely heard selections. But damn if on the very next week's show, Todd didn't play one of them. It was the theme to a show called The Wizard of Odds. And it was performed by Alan Thicke, a guy who made a run at Carson a few years back in the late night TV battle. So I can't even begin to compete with Todd when it comes to picking out rare choices of music. But I'm going to take a stab at picking something out that's a little bit unusual as I segue and hand the baton here to Todd. So let's go with one of the prettiest pieces of music that ever served as a television theme song, that of one of the great classics of TV, The Honeymooners. We'll see you next week.